From News Talk 580 1059 KMJ, this is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition. Now here's your host, Mark Kepler.
The November election has been referred to as a political tsunami. Was it as consequential as all that? We'll ask. Mindy Romero with the USC Price School of Public Policy. John Myers with the LA Times. Laurel Rosenhall with Cal Matters. And Joel Fox of Fox and Hounds.
Additional funding for the Matty Report made possible by a grant from The Wonderful Company, harvesting health and happiness around the world. From the California Channel at the State Capitol and the Matty Institute, it's the Matty Report with Executive Director of the Matty Institute, Mark Kepler.
Welcome. So voter turnout in California's midterm election was the highest in decades. Who voted and why? We'll ask our guest, Mindy Romero, who's the director of the California Civic Engagement Project at USC's Price School of Public Policy. Welcome back to the Matty Report.
Thanks for having me.
So, general voter turnout, how did it go?
It went great. It was the highest, as you said, that we've seen in decades. Quite exciting. Everybody had, lots of speculation, a lot of, thoughts, and some people putting wagers on what we would see.
I think people were worried because 2014, the last midterm, was so low. This one just blew it out of the water.
It was a record low year, and now we've gone to something that is the highest in decades, and It's quite incredible to see these numbers. And I'll let you ask.
Yeah, let me ask you this. You know, there's a lot of reporting about this growing gulf nationally between party identification of white voters with college degrees and those without college degrees. Kind of, they refer to this as the diploma divide.
Yeah.
Is that happening in California?
It happens certainly in California to some degree. And if you're talking about turnout or partisan affiliation?
Both. Either one. Take either one.
Okay. Well, partisan affiliation is a little bit different because California generally is obviously party registration much more skewed towards the Democrats than the Republicans.
Republicans are now a third, right behind no party preference.
Just fell behind no party preference. In terms of turnout, it's long been the case that we see folks that are, regarding race ethnicity, whites vote more than folks of color, and those that are of higher income or higher education in this case vote more.
It used to be, though, that higher-educated whites would probably vote Republican, and then lower-educated whites would vote Democrat. That's completely been flipped, it seems like.
I wouldn't say necessarily. I think we hear a lot about that regarding Trump and Trump supporters,
right.
Certainly. I think it still depends on what part of the country you're looking at.
California is unique. I will grant you that.
Yes.
So every election cycle, we hear the same thing, and that is, this is the year that the youth are going to turn out to vote. It's kind of like Lucy and Charlie Brown with the football. And every year people seem to be disappointed. But maybe not this year.
No.
Finally come out to vote?
I think so. So there was speculation about the women's vote, about the Latino vote, about the youth vote. Pretty much you name it, right? Mm-hmm. And while we still don't, and we won't have for a little while longer, detailed data on race, ethnicity, and so forth, just looking at those big turnout numbers that we ended up for the general population, mm-hmm. it tells us that it's a pretty good bet that we had a more representative electorate. So when you have higher turnout overall, generally speaking, it means that underrepresented groups not only voted more too, but that they closed the representation gap.
And the gap has been fairly large. I mean, I make it simplistic here, but basically young people generally don't vote. Older,
very low numbers.
Low numbers. And older, males generally do vote.
Well, take 2014. Mm-hmm. Now, granted, again, a record low turnout rate, but those age 18 to 24, their eligible voter turnout was only 8% in 2014.
I don't know if this is correct, but someone cited the fact that there were more people arrested in that age group than voted on a percentage basis. I'm not sure, but it paints a picture of how few of that age group are voting.
It paints a picture. I wouldn't make that comparison, but it does paint a picture. But you know what? This election, it won't be 8%, clearly.
Right.
And once we get into the detailed data, what's going to be really exciting is we're expecting some level, again, of that gap to decrease. So we used to be more representative than we've seen in a very long time, certainly in a midterm election. Just how good?
Remains to be seen.
Remains to be seen, but it's a pretty good bet that youth turned out, and certainly anecdotally across the state, we've heard a lot on election day, late on election day, young people using conditional voter registration for the first time.
Yeah, the last minute voter. That's
the last minute voter, but hey, they're voting.
So what
and
is
that's
all,
exciting.
What does all this mean for 2020?
I think that maybe we're going into a really unique historic period here. The forces at play that produced, at least largely produced, we think here in California, that really high turnout that we just saw, will still be, at least we think, or likely to be still be in place in 2020. Normally, whenever you have a bump in those trends that we see over time, that bump goes away by the next election cycle. It's not sustained. It's very disappointing. We get excited and then we gotta go back to low. 2010 was a very good year for turnout in California. 2014, record low turnout year. So I think we have an opportunity that we could see, now presidential is always higher than a midterm, but we could see very high numbers also in that presidential election. And really think about it, these factors have been in place since really 2016. To see this over maybe three election cycles, it's a unique opportunity if we do the work and seize on it, that we really could create, in a sense, close to a generation, particularly of young people, that voting becomes a habit. It's not just about one election cycle.
Well, I guess we're going to see. Maybe we call that the Trump effect. We want to thank our guest, Mindy Romero from USC. Up next, a post-election analysis with two astute observers of state politics, John Myers of the LA Times and Laura Rosenhall with Cal Matters. That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. I'm Mark Kepler with the Maddie Institute. You know, the November election brought us a new governor, a new legislature, but the results may have some thinking the more things change, the more they stay the same. Our guests, Laura Rosenhall from Cal Matters and John Myers from LA Times, might provide a more nuanced analysis than that. Welcome back to the Maddie Report.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, John, let me start with you. Gavin Newsom's got to deal with some things that Jerry Brown's leaving unfinished, namely the Delta tunnels and high-speed rail. In his campaign, he seemed to be advocating for this half-a-loaf approach, you know, part of, you know, one of the two tunnels, maybe part of high-speed rail going through the valley, San Joaquin Valley to the Silicon Valley, but not to L.A. Mm-hmm. What do you think is going to happen?
I don't know for sure. I read the campaign message possibly that way, you're right, Mark, but also a four-word phrase, take a closer look. I think that he wants to dig down into some of these. I think he wants to see what he makes of it and probably take the temperature of the politics of it. I think the water tunnels has a lot of really balkanized kind of feelings about it. Delta in one place in Southern California, very popular Southern California water contractors and ag. The high-speed rail is going to be tough. I mean, we just saw this audit recently come out from the state auditor that suggested serious problems with the management of the money. I almost would see those differently. I think the train is going to be scrutinized in a different way. The water is a longer fight, it seems like to me.
What do you think, Laurel?
I just don't see Newsom tackling these things right away. Yep. Even if he does get to them, I don't see it at the top of the priority list. He's made it really clear that he respects Jerry Brown's legacy. He wants to protect it. And I would be shocked if he comes out of the gate just trying to sort of change course very quickly. I think that if changes happen, it will be further down the line.
So, no pun intended.
Yeah, right.
So what do you think in terms of how does Gavin Newsom get out from under the shadow of Jerry Brown? He casts a pretty big shadow.
He does. But Newsom's already sort of talking about a lot of policy areas that would be his own, that are things that Brown hasn't shown a huge amount of interest in. So Newsom's talking a lot about sort of preschool, early care for toddlers, even for pregnant women, obviously healthcare, expanding healthcare, whether it's single payer or some other model, and then housing and homelessness. So he's really sort of talking about that suite of issues that are things that Brown, you know, he worked on, but they were not by any means his sort of signature issues.
You could throw fracking on that pile too, I suppose.
You could, but I think that one thing that, in addition to Laurel's list, which is the right list, is the structure of the tax system in California. Mm-hmm. And he has suggested that there's a conversation there that helps pay for some of these kind of programs.
Absolutely.
You did not see Jerry Brown tackle that, in part because we were in a deficit when Brown came in. I think it's going to be interesting.
Oh, that's interesting. That's the 800-pound gorilla for sure. Speaking of big, hairy, audacious goals, John. Gavin Newsom said he likes to do that kind of thing. He set out a fairly ambitious agenda on the campaign trail. What issues do you think are going to get his immediate attention? What issues are going to kind of be put off?
I think Laurel hit some of them. I think homelessness, housing issues, first and foremost. I think trying to set a path for what the fiscal health of the state is looking forward. I mean, we just got this report of a unbelievably large amount of tax windfall that is sitting in there, $29 billion between the two reserve counts, possibly by the summer of 2020.
It really is amazing when you think about he started with $20 billion deficits to where we are today. It's amazing.
And so I think that Newsom has got to articulate what he sees his path forward about the fiscal health of the state and how you do all of these things within the construct of not running into the red.
What do you think, Laurel?
Well, I think the wildfire issue is going to be back in the Capitol next year in a big way. I mean, we've just seen horrifically the state's worst fire ever, most destructive, most deadly. And Newsom said the other day that the, you know, $1 billion legislation that Jerry Brown signed in September was a good first step. So that indicates to me that, you know, he's trying to figure out what is the next step going to be on that issue. So that's one thing that may have not been really a campaign talking point, but that's going to be on the front burner. And then I think for 2020, the tax issue that John mentioned, that's going to be huge, but probably not in year one. Probably
this is
year
all
two.
A lot to tackle, though. Oh, I mean, this is a lot for any governor.
Right. Yeah. And the taxing, particularly think of split roll, you think of taxing services. Right. I mean, it's incredible. But let me ask you this, Laurel. You got a supermajority now in both houses of the legislature. So even if Gavin Newsom wants to hold a line on state spending, is he going to have some trouble in light of the Democrat supermajority that can override his veto and the fact that the LAO just published this report that the finances are fantastic?
Anything's possible, but they haven't really used their supermajority to override a veto in, what, 40
Since
years?
Since Jerry Brown.
Yeah.
Jerry
so
Brown. Yeah.
I don't think that's the biggest threat. I think the more difficult thing to navigate is just going to be the kind of different shades of Democrats. You know, with majorities that big, you know, potentially 60 Democrats in the Assembly and looking like about 28 in the Senate.
They start to splinter off into different groups, right?
Right.
A San Joaquin Valley Democrat is very different than a Bay Area Democrat.
Right. And even a Bay Area Democrat who's a real labor-friendly Democrat might be different than a Bay Area Democrat who's more of a tech, Silicon Valley-type Democrat.
And the one thing we have seen really quickly in this legislature with these large Democratic majorities over the last few years is sometimes it's harder to get to a simple majority, 41 and 21, especially 41 in the Assembly, because you have so many Democrats trying to cut side deals, and it becomes very complicated, the math in the politics.
Okay, when we come back, we're going to talk about the November propositions, that conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. I'm Mark Kepler with the Maddie Institute. We're talking with John Myers of LA Times and Laura Rosenhall with Cal Matters about the November election results. November ballot had a lot of propositions on it. Some passed, some significant ones didn't. So, Laurel, one of the big ones that didn't was this $8.9 billion water bond. You know, the general rule on water bonds is that they pass. Indeed, the last time one didn't pass was about 30 years ago. So why did this thing not pass?
There were a lot of negative editorials about it. It was not endorsed by the Democratic Party, which didn't oppose it, but, you know, given the number of voters in the state who vote Democratic, if they were looking at a slate card or something, it didn't say do this, you know. And voters may have remembered that it was just in June when they approved another water bond. So there may have been a feeling of just kind of like, maybe we don't need this.
A bond fatigue on water. And also, this is the third of a series of bond issues. And maybe by the time they got to the third one, they said enough already. And plus the size of this.
It's possible, certainly, right. I mean, it was almost $9 billion out of a $16 billion total take of bonds on this ballot. I don't know. There wasn't a huge campaign for it. It was probably too clever by half. The groups that put up all the money to get it on the ballot all had money allocated for their particular projects. And dare I say it, you know, a plug for journalism, I think there might have been the power of newspaper editorials. There was not a single newspaper in California that I can remember that said, vote for this water bond. They all said this is kind of a weird
deal. A pay-to-play.
Yeah.
I mean, it had that feel.
Water's still an issue. I'm sure we're going to hear more about that later. But John, let me ask you about this one. Another one that was kind of strange was this, the rent control measure. Polling indicates widespread public support for rent control, not to mention the whole desire of local control. This measure gave you both. It gave you the option as a local entity to go into rent control to do that if you wanted to, but it went down to defeat pretty badly.
It didn't just go down to defeat. It got walloped.
It got
shellacked. I mean, to me, this is a classic California ballot measure campaign. This is that campaign where the no side says, beware of unintended consequences. Do you know what really will happen, right? I mean, I'm almost intoning the television ads there. And I think that there were significant questions raised about what this would do in different communities. And that was hard to overcome. But it is fascinating, isn't it, that the polling shows that people are not opposed to rent control. They're worried about the cost of rents and apartments. And yet this got killed.
Well, but that's the key thing. People like rent control, and the Prop 10 campaign did not use the phrase rent control.
They didn't use that phrase. Amazing.
They kind of, their polling showed that the local control issue was going to poll better, and so they emphasized that. But I think it left a lot of voters confused, like, wait, does this do rent control? Does it not do rent control? And whenever you have a thing that's repealing another law, I think it's confusing. People are like, am I, you know, it's not automatically creating rent control.
control.
You know, another thing that kind of follows up on John's comment, that something typical about this one was the money spent.
Right. That was the other thing. You know, the opponents outspent them by like 3-1.
$75 million to $26
million. Right.
You outspend someone by 3-1, you're probably going to win,
exactly.
It sounds like. So let's talk about the other big one. That's the gas tax repeal measure. That failed. It seems like Californians over the last few years have been willing to tax someone else, the millionaire's tax or whatever, but they're not so interested in taxing themselves. This was a change. They said, okay, we're going to tax ourselves to improve roads. A sea change or a one-off?
I'm seeing a pattern, honestly. The voters agreed to the gas tax. They defeated the other proposition that would have expanded tax breaks on elderly homeowners, the Prop 13 sort of expansion. And twice in the last few years, they've voted for sales and income tax increases between Prop 30 and then the extension that we had a couple years ago to kind of push Prop 30 many years into the future. I don't know. It looks to me that the evidence points that the anti-tax movement is just weaker than it once was.
And it's the two M's, I would call it, mechanics or message here, and I don't know which it is. Mechanics of the campaign, it was awkward to vote yes when you were against something. They were outspent, very much outspent.
Absolutely.
But the messaging, yeah, you do have to wonder if there is not a tilt to the left of the California electorate, historically anti-tax or worried about tax, and maybe now not so much, even to the point that there are some groups now saying we should go back to the ballot and say earmark taxes for early childcare or something else. I think it's going to be a really interesting discussion going forward.
We're going to find out in 2020 if they put split roll, if that becomes the issue, which likely it's going to be.
It's on the ballot already.
Yeah, so that's going to be, we'll see. Yeah. So let me ask you this, John. Prop 6, that gas tax repeal, was supposed to help the Republicans that are in some of these competitive congressional seats. It didn't seem to work.
No.
It seems like Republicans virtually lost all those close races. Where do the Republicans go from here?
I don't know. I think it would have been an uphill battle even if they had the money to run the campaign. I already said that. They didn't have the money to run the campaign. I think it would have been an uphill battle. This wave was real. It was a slow wave of Democrats in California, but it was a wave nonetheless. The party has systemic issues, state and national. And it's like I was talking to somebody the other day. The state party has had problems for a while. The national problems have compounded it. You've heard Republicans just now recently say the Republican Party as we know it in California is dead.
Right.
We've got to start all over.
And that's the former Republican assembly leader.
Right.
Yeah. That's amazing.
Yeah, I think the future of the Republican Party is one of the most interesting questions in California politics right now. Internally, they're having a lot of disagreement. You have this sort of the movement that calls itself New Way, Assemblyman Chad Mays and Arnold Schwarzenegger, moderate Republicans who are kind of talking about the need to be welcoming of immigrants and embrace environmental policy, and they want to kind of see the party go that way as a way of growing and capturing more people. And then you have the Assemblyman Travis Allen, who's running for state chairman. He's completely the opposite. Embrace Trump, go hard right, and kind of be this other direction.
You know, we're going to hear about how the Republican Party is going to move forward with our next guest, which is conservative columnist Joel Fox. But I want to thank our guests here, Laura Rosenhall from Cal Matters and John Myers of the LA Times. Back in a moment. Welcome back. I'm Mark Kepler with the Maddie Institute. So what do the election results mean for California's other party, the Republicans? Our guest is Joel Fox, editor and co-publisher of Fox and Hounds Daily, which covers California politics. His background also includes work as president of the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association for 19 years, from 1986 to 98. Welcome to the Maddie Report.
Thank you, Mark.
So Democrats have every statewide office for the third election cycle in a row.
Right.
They've won a supermajority in both houses of the legislature. And for the first time in 130 years, we have a Democrat following another Democrat as governor. Indeed, Gavin Newsom is the stuff, really, of Republican nightmares, the quintessential Bay Area liberal. What can be done to save the Republican Party from extinction?
Certainly is a one-party state right now, isn't it? It depends what the Democrats give the Republicans, because the Democrats could go wild with that kind of a scenario. Every constitutional office, two-thirds vote, they can raise taxes, they can put constitutional amendments on the ballot. So if they go too far, that would help revive Republicans. And let's not forget, we've heard the death knell of Republicans before. At least I'm old enough to remember that after Barry Goldwater was defeated in the 64 presidential election, Republicans were dead and buried until
Ronald
Reagan came along.
Well, then also, Nixon in 68.
There is no shying away from the fact that the Republican Party in California is wounded.
Bill Whalen, who's a former speechwriter for Governor Schwarzenegger, he's a fellow at Stanford's Hoover Institution, has stated that given California's changing demographics, the Republican Party's problem is both its message and its messengers. Do you agree?
I think Bill was with Pete Wilson when he was speechwriter, and he's a very astute guy, and I think there are elements to what he says. However, I think it's not so much the message and the messengers. I mean, look at some of the Orange County races where there were Republican people of color or Asian candidates, things like that, that could identify with some of the minority groups down there. I think it's that the Republican label is tarnished nationwide. If you have that R behind your name, automatically people won't give you an opportunity to make your arguments. And I think it's that tarnished image, that tarnished label, that it really doesn't give Republicans out of the starting blocks.
You know, we were talking about this earlier, and you had mentioned that you're kind of the proof of your argument is at the local level, Republicans are getting elected.
In fact,
these are considered nonpartisan
races. Those are nonpartisan races. Right. You don't see that R on the ballot. And traditionally, statewide, Republicans do fairly well in city and county races. Has that changed since we've become so bitterly polarized? Well, I don't know that from this recent election, but traditionally, Republicans do okay in those races, because they run on an agenda that the voters approve.
You know, one of the interesting things about this last election was the failure of Prop 6, the attempt to repeal the gas tax. And some people think that now that taxes maybe aren't the third rail of politics that they used to be. Do you agree?
It's going to be tested because the greatest symbol of the tax revolt is Proposition 13. And they're going to start coming after that. Already a split roll in which commercial property would be taxed differently than residential property is qualified for the ballot. Does that move forward? They're going to talk about dismantling Proposition 13. That's going to be the big argument. But there's no question that voters recently have passed income tax, sales tax, refused to repeal the gas tax. So there has been a shift on California's notorious reputation as being tax resistant.
So where does the California Republican Party go from here? Do they focus maybe in the short term on the initiative process? Do they focus long term on maybe getting more attractive candidates in terms of and in issues like things like teacher tenure, public employee pensions? And where do they go from here?
I think that the initiative process will be the vehicle or the tool to try to bring some balance to the ideological debate, because they can't do anything in the legislature, but they can go directly to the people. That's why it was created, to go around the legislature. You go directly to the people with your arguments. And even in this past election, the ideological bent of the voters was not all one-sided in the initiative process, and I don't think it will be. So the Republicans have an opportunity to present some of their arguments through the initiative process.
And what about long-term in terms of issues like public employee pensions? That's increasingly becoming a bigger and bigger issue, teacher tenure. Are those issues that might be something the Republicans can kind of latch onto?
Well, I was part of an effort with Governor Schwarzenegger a few years back when those two issues were part of his ballot propositions, and they were defeated pretty handily. So there's potential for them to come back. Those are issues of importance, because as the pensions grow and governments have to put more and more money into pensions, they have less and less to put in services. And that's going to become an issue.
Okay, well, I want to thank Joel Fox for joining us. This is Mark Kepler for the Maddie Report. Thank you for joining us.
Up next, we'll also hear from Mike Dunbar with the Merced Sun Star Modesto Bee, Rory Appleton with the Fresno Bee, Paul Hurley, formerly with the Visalia Times Delta, and Ivy Cargill, professor of political science at CSU Bakersfield.
You're listening to the Maddie Report, Valley Views Edition on KMJ.
Welcome back. There were some surprising results in the San Joaquin Valley elections this last November. With us to take a closer look at the results and what they may mean for the Valley are Mike Dunbar with the Merced Sun Star and the Modesto Bee, Rory Appleton with the Fresno Bee, Paul Hurley, formerly with the Visalia Times Delta, and Ivy Cargill, who is professor of political science at CSU Bakersfield. Welcome all of you to the Maddie Report. So let's get right into it. So Professor Cargill at Cal State Bakersfield, let me start with you first. Let's talk about turnout. Did you see any significant differences in turnout this election in Kern County and South Valley?
Yeah, we actually did see, we saw increased turnout definitely from the last couple of midterm elections. Now, I will say, the numbers aren't all in yet, so we don't have a very specific demographic breakdown as far, especially since the election hasn't been certified yet, but what we did see is that there was a turnout of a little over 64%, which in that's in the entire state of California, I have to add, which means then that if the entire state pretty much turned out a lot more, my assumption is that that's going to trickle into Kern County as well. And we definitely, at least on the college campus, relative to 2016, I think you did see a little bit more buzz. I know that the students on campus were organized several events throughout the last couple of weeks in October and the first week in November to really try to get students mobilized.
You know,
so that I thought was really interesting.
Yeah, that's interesting because the youth typically they don't vote. So that is really interesting. Let me ask Paul. You know, going we'll move up the we're going north in the valley here. So Kings County and Tulare County. Paul, did you see a greater turnout in those areas?
Turnout was definitely higher here in Tulare County and this part of the valley. It was approaching presidential election turnout. I'm not sure the final percentage, but it was well over 50%, close to 60%. And for this county, that is very high, where a midterm election usually draws in the low 30s.
Yeah,
it was a big turnout.
You know, so Rory, you know, the kind of the central part of the San Joaquin Valley, you know, Madera County, Fresno County, what were you seeing there in terms of turnout?
Yeah, just like everyone else, you know, it was more comparable to a 2016 sort of presidential election rather than a midterm. I happen to know in Kings, Tulare, Fresno, we were in the high 50s, 58, 57. In Madera, it actually got up to almost 70 because Madera
wow.
was part of the state's sort of pilot program where they sent absentee ballots to everybody. And then they just had a sort of different way of voting this time. And it seemed like the results were very, very very, very favorable in the sense that almost 70% turned out and they were done counting a full
those
week,
are presidential election
yeah
year
absolutely. I mean, Madera turns out a lot. In the presidential, I went and looked, they had 76% turnout.
Wow.
So a lot of people vote and a lot of people vote absentee.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, like the last midterm in 2014, the numbers were like in the 40s around the states. That's
yeah,
a huge
yeah. In
jump.
Fresno County, it was 39% and we're up to 58 now. So
Mike, in the north part of the valley, what'd you see up there?
Same thing. We had 59.6%, nearly 60% in Stanislaus County, and we had 61.9% in Merced County, which was quite high. It was 15 points higher than 2014, but if you go back a couple of midterms back, it's usually in the 50s, the low 50s here. So it was even better than that. What we did find was we found a lot of complaints about the vote harvesting here, which I don't know if that had an impact or not, but I do know a lot of ballots arrived in Moss.
Yeah, I know. Congressman Denham has been talking about that. But let me ask you this, Mike, about the props. I'm only going to get to some of these issues. The props, one of them that really had a big impact on the valley was this $8.9 billion water bond that went down to defeat, which is a little unusual. As a general rule, water bonds almost always pass. Indeed, you'd have to go back about 30 years, back to 1990, to find the last time the voters rejected a water bond. I mean, since then, 9 water bonds have passed. Why do you think this one didn't?
Well, I think there are two reasons. The first is I don't think it was a particularly good bond. It was loaded up with a lot of stuff that would help Southern California. They didn't do a good job selling it in the north. And secondly, if you go back to the water bond we passed in 2014, it's been 4 years, and nobody has seen anything come across yet. I mean, there's been no storage built. The state didn't do what it promised to do. So I think a lot of people are upset that the state doesn't seem to be spending the money it has. And then they're also looking at things that are in the bond and thinking perhaps this is a bailout of local governments. So I think those two things combined.
Rory, what do you think was going on there?
Yeah, I think the same thing. Among local people, especially conservatives, it seemed like we hadn't seen much movement in the last bond. So I think people are always sort of loath to spend more money when they're not getting any of the money they've already agreed to spend. I also think it was just one of those. It was sort of packaged as, about half of it, at least locally, we're saying, about half of it's going to go to the valley and all things like that, which is, great for the valley. But again, you look at the population hubs in Northern California and stuff, they don't care about that.
That's not where the votes are.
I think also it was sort of overshadowed by sort of the larger props on there, the Prop 6, the Prop 10,
mm-hmm.
Prop 10 especially. I mean, I just think
it was also the third bond measure in a row, right?
Yeah.
By the time they get to the third one, maybe they had bond fatigue.
Yeah, absolutely.
Professor Cargill, any comments on this water bond and why it didn't pass?
No, I agree. I mean, everything I have is pretty much what has already been said. I think in addition to bond fatigue, I think it was also, we can't reiterate enough just when you look at the language of the language on the ballot, you know, it wasn't very clear to voters. And I think that voters, just with the nationalization of the midterm, I don't think voters were paying enough close attention to it to really understand what was being proposed. So they just voted no.
And if they don't understand,
and again,
they vote
going back to the idea that there's no.
Right.
Yeah,
right,
and again,
right.
You haven't seen any benefits from 2014, so what's the point?
Right, right. Roy, let me ask you this. You know, Governor-elect Newsom has been in the Valley after the election, which is a little unusual, you know, for a governor-elect to come to the Valley after an election. What do you think Newsom's election means for the Valley?
Well, I think he's definitely trying to show a sensitivity to that issue. I think he's well aware that many people in the Valley feel like Governor Brown sort of abandoned us and was, you know, almost – governing from two coasts, so to speak. And I think that there's a lot of optimism among electeds locally. I was at the event that he had just recently, and I spoke to Fresno City Council President Esmeralda Soria and Joaquin Arambula, the assemblyman, as well as Melissa Hurtado, the senator, you know, and I think there's a lot of optimism that we can get heard. But if you sort of listen to what he was saying, he was essentially saying, you know, I'm welcoming the Valley to the table, but there's a whole lot of stuff pulling at me in terms. I mean, he had a statement just a couple of weeks ago coming out and saying the Democrats are really going to have to pare down what they want to spend. And so I think he's giving us, you know, he's definitely taking a listening tour, but I don't know if it'll be too much beyond that.
Yeah, well, hopefully more than just symbolic. Paul, I want to ask you, you know the Democrats now have supermajorities in both houses of the state legislature, and some of these Valley elections really directly were impactful in that happening. One of the biggest surprises came in the South Valley, where Melissa Hurtado, a healthcare advocate and a political rookie, really, defeated Republican State Senator Andy Vidak. You also had a situation where Assemblymember Rudy Salas won a fourth term, holding off Hanford City Councilmember Justin Mendez. I mean, what's your take on that, Paul?
As far as I'm not quite sure about the Salas-Mendez one, but Andy Vidak was a very good representative for his district, so I'm kind of surprised he lost. But this is actually a Democratic district, so this election sort of righted what is actually supposed to take place. You know, it was one of those things, along with the Valdeo district, was carved out as kind of like, okay, we're going to give Democrats a heavily favored district here in the Valley, so that the Republicans can take the rest of the table. This time, the Democrats turned out, Latino voters turned out. I think what we're saying is, yes, the Valley is turning a little bit more purplish, and I think that was the result. You see that in this election where Hurtado defeating Vidak.
Well, Professor Cargill, let me ask you about that Rudy Salas race.
I would add that in this area, that was just one of several Latino victories. Raymond Macarena being elected to he was for the supervisors. His nephew, Reuben Macro, his uncle, actually, Reuben Macarena being elected in Farmersville. There were several strong Latino victories in this election.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask Professor Cargill over down in Bakersfield about this Rudy Salas victory for getting his fourth term over Hanford City Council member Justin Mendez. Did that surprise you?
No, I mean, he's the incumbent, and he has a presence in the Bakersfield area. I mean, he won the election 67% to 32% that Justin Mendez got. He had the power of incumbency, and while at one point we thought that maybe Mendez was gaining ground on him, Salas was able to mobilize. You know, the area that he represents is heavily Latino. And Latinos, if Latinos are mobilized, if Latinos are made to engage, they will engage. Salas was successful in doing that. Mendez's message just wasn't strong enough to really differentiate himself from Salas. And people know the Salas name, so why not just continue voting for him?
Mike, let me ask you about the race with in the North Valley, where Democratic Assemblywoman Anna Caballero, who had lost to State Senator Anthony Cannell in 2010, this time, she defeated Madera County Supervisor Rob Portras for Cannell's seat. He's termed out in a race that many Democrats were targeting as a key race for them to get their supermajority in the state Senate. What were your thoughts on that race?
Well, Caballero is a strong candidate regardless. And I think that this, like some of these other districts, it was traditionally a Democratic district. Cannell won it
mainly because he was sort of a rogue Republican. He charted his own path, a path that ended up being pretty important to Jerry Brown. So I think Caballero simply righted the ship, if you will, even though the race got pretty nasty from what I'm told in Salinas. And, I mean, some of the commercials I saw, we didn't see it in this market, which is you have to compete with Sacramento to get ad time in this market. But elsewhere, the race was kind of nasty. So I was kind of gratified that it went to Caballero, who didn't get down as low as the Republican candidate.
Mm. What was it? It was a district that certainly the Democrats had been targeting. Rory, let me ask you about the kind of the central part of the valley here. You had former Fresno County Supervisor Andres Borges won the seat vacated by Republican State Senator Tom Berryhill. No big surprise there. The big winner seems to be the Democrat Fresno State Assembly Member Joaquin Arambula, who appears to be positioned really for a significant role in the upcoming legislature.
Yeah, I think so. I think when you look at the legislators from around this area, I think he's the most likely to get something done. He's latched onto the Lara bill, which would extend Medi-Cal to undocumented migrants over the age of 19.
And of course, he's a doctor.
I was always surprised in the most recent session that they didn't lean on him more as being the only doctor in the legislature on all these very, very important healthcare issues that are coming up. But I think also just in a variety of issues, especially representing this area. I mean, if you just look, I mean, Patterson, Assemblyman Patterson, where he lies. You know where Assemblyman Devin Mathis lie. They're both going to be deep in the minority, and, you know, they're sort of just kind of churning against this Democratic system. You know, I think Caballero is going to be a player a little bit, and Hurtado is just a freshman and the youngest senator they've ever had, basically. So,
Could be under his wing in a way.
Exactly. I think Arambula is just now positioned. Both he's got obviously the name recognition and the pedigree of it, but also the background, and now he's had a little bit of time. I think he has the best chance of getting something done for the Valley.
Okay. Well, up next, what about the Valley's congressional races? What does it mean for the Republican Party, not just in the state, but in the Valley? That conversation in a moment. This is the Matty Report Valley Views Edition. Up next, a closer look at the election results in the Valley with Mike Dunbar of the Merced Sun Star and Modesto Bee, Rory Appleton with the Fresno Bee, Paul Hurley, formerly with the Visalia Times Delta, and Ivy Cargill, professor of political science at CSU Bakersfield.
You're listening to the Matty Report Valley Views Edition on KMJ.
Welcome back. I'm Mark Kepler with the Matty Institute, and we're taking a closer look at Valley races and the results from last November's election with Ivy Cargill, a professor of political science at CSU Bakersfield, Paul Hurley, formerly with the Visalia Times Delta, Mike Dunbar with the Merced Sun Star Modesto Bee, and Rory Appleton with the Fresno Bee. So, Rory, let me start with you. Many people, I think I put myself in that group as well. A lot of people were surprised by the T.J. Cox, David Valadao race, since he seemed to be winning on election night. What happened and why?
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty much a total shock, I think. I think most people thought Valadao was an extremely safe, kind of a moderate, hyper-local type candidate. The demographics have favored a Democrat for years now. We all sort of know that. But I think T.J. Cox was able to break through just because the Democrats really, really worked hard in that district. They had somebody there even before Cox was there, months, almost a year before Cox was there. They had people on the ground identifying issues. I think it was a race like Denham in which Valadao was hurt by the national Republican agenda. I don't think that there's any way to debate that. I think healthcare, immigration, the family separation, I think that tagged him in some way.
The tax law where you can no longer deduct.
The tax law, exactly. And I think there was also, that ballot harvesting. I've spoken to the Democratic strategist who was, handling this for the DCCC, and they basically said, ballot harvesting accounted for about 1% of sort of the ballots that we picked up, which in most races like Denham's really wasn't that big of a deal. But in this race, it was less than 1%. Mm-hmm. So I think that really that final push of the Democrats having staff.
Could you define for our audience absolutely what ballot harvesting is?
Yeah. So basically, it's a legal maneuver, basically, in which Democrats send staffers to people's houses, absentee ballots, and they basically say, hey, we have you down as no party preference. Can I take your ballot for you? And they can, the voter can sign the ballot to that staffer who then takes it to a polling place.
But it's
for
in an
them.
Envelope sealed.
It's
and
in
signed.
An envelope sealed and signed, and the clerks have a sort of a vetting process of these, and it is totally legal in California and a few other states. It seems in covering these races that the Democrats took full advantage of it, and the Republicans did hardly any, if at all, of this. And in this race, it might have been the difference.
Professor Cargill, real quickly, what do you think? Were you surprised by this result?
Was surprised, but at the same time, in hindsight, now I think about the fact that, going back to something that Rory just said, I think that the Republicans just didn't think that that the Democrats were actually going to be able to flip the seat. I think that Cox was very successful, particularly in Spanish language media. We have to remember the fact that the district, the 21st district, isn't solely English speaking. Cox was very good about commercials and just making sure his name was out there with the Latino community.
I'm sorry. But one of the advantages that Valde always had was he spoke Spanish. I always thought that was one of his advantages.
Right. But the thing is that Latinos are now realizing that Valadeo is not Latino, that Valadeo is actually Portuguese.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Cox played on that. Hmm. And Cox was also able to successfully link Valadeo to Donald Trump, and Latinos do not like Donald Trump. Now, it's not the case that all Latinos don't like him, but a lot of Latinos do not like him, and Cox was successful in connecting him 99% of the time. So that really helps. If you mobilize Latino voters and you engage them, they will come out, and he did that.
Yeah, what you're pointing to really to two things: that typical voters that don't come out, the youth and Hispanics, they came out this time. Mike, let me ask you about that.
They sure did.
Yeah, the Josh Harder-Jeff Denham race. That was a little bit more predictable. Denham's always been viewed, as a swing district, been a target for the Democrats for a long time. Did Josh Harder win that race, or did Jeff Denham lose that race?
Well, I don't know that. I think Denham was outworked. I think that's the main thing. But I think Denham did a lot to hurt himself in that race. In 2016, 1,000 people turned out to a town hall meeting, and they weren't expecting that kind of crowd. And they wanted to talk about their medical insurance. And Denham didn't have good answers for them, but he did promise not to vote for anything that didn't have protection for pre-existing conditions. And within 2 weeks, he had done exactly the opposite of what he said he would do. I don't think voters forgot. I will say that I ran into the head of the local Chamber of Commerce on Saturday, and he just insisted that Harder's going to be a one-term congressman. I don't think that's true. I think that's wishful thinking. I think that what we saw was a lot of reaction to Trump and the fact that Jeff Denham was voted with him in 97% of the cases. And I think that there's going to be a lot of anti-Trump, just as Professor Cargill stated.
Yeah,
there's
going to
be
district,
a lot of anti-Trump sentiment here.
That district is changing, too, with the people coming in from the Bay Area and whatnot. That district is changing. It's certainly becoming more purple. Roy, I want to ask you real quickly about Congressman Devin Nunes, who had a much closer race than normal. I mean, normally he wins by 35% or something.
Yeah.
This time it was just 7 points over Fresno County Prosecutor Andrew Janz. Does this make Nunes vulnerable for 2020?
Well, I think the margin, maybe not necessarily as much as the total victory that the Democrats had in California. I mean, they're going to be able to defend incumbencies now. And so who are they going to target? I mean, who's sort of left? And so I think you see this district as, you know, I think Devin Nunes is a you know, sort of a head they want on the wall, you know, more
than
anything.
There's only seven, I think, Republican congressmen in California. So that,
yeah, you know. Exactly. So I think that's part of it. I also think, you know, it was a national race. There's $20 million raised. Right. It was a huge,
I think it was the most expensive congressional race in the country.
And I think, you know, Janz is a young guy. He still has plenty of momentum. I think he can go into 2020 with a blue wave on his back in terms of presidential turnout. And just, you know, I think he can try his chance again.
You know, I want to get to, a question. Paul, I want to ask you this one because it affects this last question. That is, you know, it's difficult not to look at the November election results and not come to the conclusion that Republicans just got trounced statewide. I mean, no statewide elected office, no a super majority of Democrats in both houses of the state legislature, losses in virtually every contested congressional seat, and defeat of Prop 6, the gas repeal tax. And, you know, they did much worse than normal in the Valley. And you know, example of the Harder situation, T.J. Cox and even Devin Nunes. Where do they go from here?
That's a good question. They obviously have to go closer to the center, and they have to put some distance between them and the president and Donald Trump. That is going to be a big problem for them in 2020. I'd just like to go back to the Devin Nunes race. You know, Devin ran harder, advertised, put more money into advertising, did a lot of negative advertising in this race, and he still won, obviously, but it was really close. Is he vulnerable for 2020? I think Devin Nunes holds onto that seat until the district is redrawn in 2022. It is just too strongly Republican. However, here in the South Valley, I heard a lot of Republicans putting a little bit of distance between them and Devin Nunes now. They do not like his grandstanding on a national scene. They do not like the way he has gotten so close to Donald Trump, who's done little for, well, for instance, agricultural interests in the Valley. That said, back to the your original questions about Republicans. Until the Republicans start providing things, start giving some people in the Valley some of the things that they need on issues such as immigration, water, agriculture, and trade, yeah, they're going to continue to see their influence in the Valley slip.
Yeah, and I think, you know, health care is another big issue, obviously, because so many people in the Valley don't have health care. Mike, let me ask you, what are your thoughts here? Was it message or messenger with the Republican situation this last election?
Well, it was a combination. The funny thing is the Republicans had a lot of really attractive or good messengers available to them. They just rejected them. We have a county supervisor here who used to be in the assembly. She was the minority leader in the assembly, Kristen Olson. She very publicly distanced herself from the Republican Party just recently, first at a forum at the Sacramento Bee and then secondly in a Cal Matters op-ed. And she's very conservative. You can't accuse her of being liberal, but she's not mean. She's not vindictive, and she doesn't get angry at immigrants or anyone else. And that's the kind of thing the Republicans need to find. They need to find the candidates who can make the conservative argument without the cruelty.
I want to ask Professor Cargill that same question. I mean, where does the California Republican Party go generally and Valley Republicans specifically?
I can't stress enough what has already been said about the fact that they're going to have to distance themselves from Donald Trump. And in 2020, that's going to be an extreme challenge. But I think also, too, what they have to do is they have to really pay attention to the local issues. You know, there's this idea that the Republican Party, they're conservative party, but the type of conservatism that we're seeing the Republican Party go into is not the William F. Buckley conservatism. And I think that for Republicans here in California, that's what they're looking for. They're looking for what they originally bought into, the ideas of Buckley. And that's not what we see right now. Right now, it's all about a power grab, right? And it's a power grab by any means necessary. It's what we're seeing at the national level. And for Republicans, I mean, we know that California Republicans are not buying into that, particularly the ones in the Valley. We also have a lot of no party preference voters who are probably not necessarily liberal, but they don't like what is happening with the Republican Party at large. And so if Republicans want to get those no party preference voters that are actually turning the Republican Party into third party status in the state, right, they're going to have to really get to to those local issues. Yeah, they're going to have to really pay attention to what constituents want.
No, that's interesting.
And even maybe differentiate themselves from national Republicans.
Yeah, that's interesting. I say about the no party preference, and they are now more registrations for no party preference than Republicans in the state. Yeah. So Rory, I want to end with you the same question. What is the way out of the political wilderness for the Republican Party?
Yeah, I mean, I have to agree with everybody. I really think it's a major branding issue. It's not just, you know, sort of Kristen Olson, but also Governor Schwarzenegger has come out and basically started a new institute for, like, how to be a quote-unquote good Republican versus
I think they're calling
that
it the third way.
Yeah, and so, you know, I think you're going to have candidates who can distance themselves from the national issues, but also have a very defensible pedigree in terms of getting local things done. People who've accomplished things in local office for water, for immigration.
You know, it's
for
interesting
healthcare.
You say that, because if you look around the state, Republicans do have a lot of the local elected offices. There seems to have, I would think, a pretty deep bench.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's going to be. I think you still see, if you look at the county sort of breakdown of statewide races, like, you know, Fresno County and things like that still go for Prop 6, still went for John Cox. You see that the Republican kind of base is there, but you're also going to have to get young, those no party preference voters to sort of change. And I also think, you know, we talked a little bit about the ballot harvesting thing. I think Republicans are going to have to update their tactics as well. I think Republicans were late to the airwaves On a lot of these races that they lost, I think they were late to, as the professor had noted, bilingual, you know, things like that. And so you're going to have to really kind of update your tactics.
And I'm sure they will. Well, I want to I want to thank our guests. What a fantastic discussion. Mike Dunbar with the Merced Sun Star Modesto B, Rory Appleton with the Fresno B, Paul Hurley, formerly with the Visalia Times Delta, and Professor Ivy Cargill with the CSU Bakersfield Political Science Department. Thanks, all of you.
The views expressed in the Maddie Report are those of the individuals participating in the program and do not necessarily reflect those of the California Channel or the Maddie Institute. If you'd like to share your thoughts about the points and opinions expressed on the Maddie Report, visit our website at maddieinstitute.org.
The Maddie Report, Valley Views Edition, is a public affairs partnership between KMJ Radio, Cumulus Media, and the nonpartisan Maddie Institute, providing the Valley with valuable insight and analysis on politics and important public policy issues. This is KMJ.